ages, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver.
It appeared to me that men remain in their present low and primitive condition. But if they should feel the influence of the spring of springs arousing them, they would of necessity rise to a higher and more ethereal life.
You're listening to episode 643 of Unwelcome Guests, Living a Higher and More Ethereal Life. I'm Robin Upton, and I drew that title from Henry David Thoreau's Walden. You should be hearing the context in our first hour, and supplementing that with an interview about foreclosures and activists resisting them en masse in the Portland area in the Northeast US. Now, why did I pick that title for the show? I found it interesting to speculate on what Thoreau was thinking about, and interesting that he describes men in the plural, meaning people in the lingo of the time. I think he was spending time outside of society, allowed him to get his bearings and decide how much of society he missed and how much he could rather do without. And he noticed how much of the things that people think are essential, how much of what they spend their time on is actually not only irrelevant, but worse than useless, whether we look in terms of consuming resources or in terms of distracting people from what's really important. And he lives alone in nature, has plenty of time to look at how the animals behave, the natural world, and comes to some radically different conclusions about what's important. Well, is it beyond imagination that even in our large numbers, in our societies, even in our cities, we might all decide that fighting one another, money, fashion, and a thousand other things which seem to be so important to a lot of people nowadays turn out not to be important at all? Perhaps human relationships, perhaps eating properly, perhaps living in with love for the world around us, perhaps these things are very important, and we should realize it not just on a personal level, but en masse. Could this suddenly sweep the world? Well, the thought would have been a bit unimaginable when Walden was written in 1845, but with the modern communications technology, I think it certainly could. Now, whether it would take flaming fireballs in the skies, an act of God to bring people to their higher senses, I don't know. Let's hear what led up to Thoreau's wondering about us all living a higher and more ethereal life.
And if the civilized man's pursuits are no worthier than the savage's, if he is employed the greater part of his life in obtaining gross necessaries and comforts merely, why should he have a better dwelling than the former? But how do the poor minority fare? Perhaps it will be found that just in proportion as some have been placed in outward circumstances above the savage, others have been degraded below him. The luxury of one class is counterbalanced by the indigence of another. On the one side is the palace. On the other are the almshouse and silent poor. The myriads who built the pyramids to be the tombs of the pharaohs were fed on garlic, and it may be were not decently buried themselves. The mason who finishes the cornice of the palace returns at night perchance to a hut not so good as a wigwam. It is a mistake to suppose that in a country where the usual evidences of civilization exist, the condition of a very large body of the inhabitants may not be as degraded as that of savages. I refer to the degraded poor, not now to the degraded rich. To know this, I should not need to look farther than to the shanties, which everywhere border our railroads, that last improvement in civilization, where I see in my daily walks human beings living in sties, and all winter with an open door, for the sake of light, without any visible, often imaginable, woodpile, and the forms of both old and young are permanently contracted by the long habit of shrinking from cold and misery, and the development of all their limbs and faculties is checked. It certainly is fair to look at that class by whose labor the works which distinguish this generation are accomplished. Such, too, to a greater or less extent, is the condition of the operatives of every denomination in England, which is the great workhouse of the world. Or I could refer you to Ireland, which is marked as one of the white or enlightened spots on the map. Contrast the physical condition of the Irish with that of the North American Indian, or the South Sea Islander, or any other savage race before it was degraded by contact with the civilized man. Yet I have no doubt that people's rulers are as wise as the average of civilized rulers. Their condition only proves what squalidness may consist with civilization. I hardly need refer now to the laborers in our southern states, who produce the staple exports of this country, and are themselves a staple production of the South, but to confine myself to those who are said to be in moderate circumstances. Most men appear never to have considered what a house is, and are actually, though needlessly, poor all their lives because they think that they must have such a one as their neighbors have. As if one were to wear any sort of coat which the tailor might cut out for him, or, gradually leaving off palm-leaf hat or cap of woodchuck skin, complain of hard times because he could not afford to buy him a crown. It is possible to invent a house still more convenient and luxurious than we have, which yet all would admit that man could not afford to pay for. Shall we always study to obtain more of these things, and not sometimes to be content with less? Shall the respectable citizen thus gravely teach by precept and example the necessity of the young man's providing a certain number of superfluous glow-shoes and umbrellas and empty guest-chambers for empty guests before he dies? Why should not our furniture be as simple as the Arabs or the Indians? When I think of the benefactors of the race, whom we have apotheosized as messengers from heaven, bearers of divine gifts to man, I do not see in my mind any retinue at their heels, any carload of fashionable furniture. Or what if I were to allow, would it not be a singular allowance, that our furniture should be more complex than the Arabs, in proportion as we are morally and intellectually his superiors? At present our houses are cluttered and defiled with it, and a good housewife would sweep out the greater part into the dust-hole, and not leave her morning's work undone. Morning work! By the blushes of Aurora and the music of Memnon, What should be man's morning work in this world? I had 3 pieces of limestone on my desk, but I was terrified to find that they required to be dusted daily, when the furniture of my mind was all undusted still, and threw them out the window in disgust. How, then, could I have a furnished house? I would rather sit in the open air, for no dust gathers on the grass, unless where man has broken ground. It is the luxurious and dissipated who set the fashions which the herd so diligently follow. The traveller who stops at the best houses, so-called, soon discovers this. For the publicans presume him to be a Sardanapalus. And if he resigned himself to their tender mercies, he would soon be completely emasculated. I think that in the railroad car we are inclined to spend more on luxury than on safety and convenience, and it threatens, without attaining these, to become no better than a modern drawing-room, with its divans and ottomans and sunshades and 100 other oriental things, which we are taking west with us, invented for the ladies of the harem and the effeminate natives of the celestial empire, which Jonathan should be ashamed to know the names of. I would rather sit on a pumpkin and have it all to myself than be crowded on a velvet cushion. I would rather ride on earth in an ox-cart, with a free circulation, than go to heaven in the fancy car of an excursion train and breathe a malaria all the way. The very simplicity and nakedness of man's life in the primitive ages imply this advantage, at least, that they left him still but a sojourner in nature. When he was refreshed with food and sleep, he contemplated his journey again. He dwelt, as it were, in a tent in this world, and was either threading the valleys, or crossing the plains, or climbing the mountaintops. But lo, men have become the tools of their tools. The man who independently plucked the fruits when he was hungry has become a farmer, and he who stood under a tree for shelter, a housekeeper. We now no longer camp as for a night, but have settled down on earth and forgotten heaven. We have adopted Christianity merely as an improved method of agriculture. We have built for this world a family mansion, and for the next, a family tomb. The best works of art are the expression of man's struggle to free himself from this condition. But the effect of our art is merely to make this low state comfortable, and that higher state to be forgotten. There is actually no place in this village for a work of fine art, if any had come down to us, to stand. For our lives, our houses and streets, furnish no proper pedestal for it. There is not a nail to hang a picture on, nor a shelf to receive the bust of a hero or a saint. When I consider how our houses are built and paid for, or not paid for, and their internal economy managed and sustained, I wonder that the floor does not give way under the visitor while he is admiring the gewgaws upon the mantelpiece, and let him through into the cellar to some solid and honest, though earthy, foundation. I cannot but perceive that this so-called rich and refined life is a thing jumped at, and I do not get on in the enjoyment of the fine arts which adorn it. my attention being wholly occupied with the jump. For I remember that the greatest genuine leap due to human muscles alone, on record, is that of certain wandering Arabs who are said to have cleared 25 feet on level ground. Without factitious support, man is sure to come to earth again beyond that distance. The first question which I am tempted to put to the proprietor of such great impropriety is, who bolsters you? Are you one of the 97 who fail, or the 3 who succeed? Answer me these questions, and then perhaps I may look at your baubles and find them ornamental. The cart before the horse is neither beautiful nor useful. Before we can adorn our houses with beautiful objects, the walls must be stripped, and our lives must be stripped, and beautiful housekeeping and beautiful living be laid for a foundation. Now, a taste for the beautiful is most cultivated out of doors, where there is no house and no housekeeper. Old Johnson, in his Wonder-Working Providence, speaking of the first settlers of this town, with whom he was contemporary, tells us that, quote, "they burrow themselves in the earth for their first shelter under some hillside, and, casting the soil aloft upon timber, they make a smoky fire against the earth at the highest side," end quote. They did not, quote, "provide them houses," end quote, says he, quote, "till the earth, by the Lord's blessing, brought forth bread to feed them," end quote. And the first year's crop was so light that, quote, "they were forced to cut their bread very thin for a long season," end quote. The secretary of the province of New Netherland, writing in Dutch in 1650, for the information of those who wished to take up land there, states more particularly that, quote, "those in New Netherland, and especially in New England, who have no means to build farmhouses, at first according to their wishes, dig a square pit in the ground, cellar fashion, 6 or 7 feet deep, as long and as broad as they think proper, case the earth inside with wood all around the wall, and line the wood with the bark of trees or something else to prevent the caving in of the earth. Floor this cellar with plank, and wainscot it overhead for a ceiling. Raise a roof of spars clear up, and cover the spars with bark or green sods, so that they can live dry and warm in these houses, with their entire families for 2, 3, and 4 years, it being understood that partitions are run through these cellars, which are adapted to the size of the family. The wealthy and principal men in New England, in the beginning of the colonies, commenced their first dwelling-houses in this fashion for 2 reasons. Firstly, in order not to waste time in building, and not to want food the next season. Secondly, in order not to discourage poor laboring people, whom they brought over in numbers from fatherland. In the course of 3 or 4 years, when the country became adapted to agriculture, they built themselves handsome houses, spending on them several thousands. End quote. In this course which our ancestors took, there was a show of prudence, at least, as if their principle were to satisfy the more pressing wants first. But are the more pressing wants satisfied now? When I think of acquiring for myself one of our luxurious dwellings, I am deterred, for, so to speak, the country is not yet adapted to human culture, and we are still forced to cut our spiritual bread far thinner than our forefathers did their wheaten. Not that all architectural ornament is to be neglected, even in the rudest periods. But let our houses first be lined with beauty, where they come in contact with our lives, like the tenement of the shellfish, and not overlaid with it. But, alas, I have been inside one or two of them, and know what they are lined with. Though we are not so degenerate, but that we might possibly live in a cave or a wigwam, or wear skins today, it certainly is better to accept the advantages, though so dearly bought, which the invention and industry of mankind offer. In such a neighborhood as this, boards and shingles, lime and bricks are cheaper and more easily obtained than suitable caves, or whole logs, or bark in sufficient quantities, or even well-tempered clay of or flat stones. I speak understandingly on this subject, for I have made myself acquainted with it both theoretically and practically. With a little more wit, we might use these materials so as to become richer than the richest now are, and make our civilization a blessing. The civilized man is a more experienced and wiser savage. But to make haste to my own experiment. Near the end of March 1845, I borrowed an axe and went down to the woods by Walden Pond, nearest to where I intended to build my house, and began to cut down some tall, arrowy white pines, still in their youth, for timber. It is difficult to begin without borrowing, but perhaps it is the most generous course, thus to permit your fellow man to have an interest in your enterprise. The owner of the axe, as he released his hold on it, said that it was the apple of his eye, but I returned it sharper than I received it. It was a pleasant hillside where I worked, covered with pine woods, through which I looked out on the pond, and a small open field in the woods, where pines and hickories were springing up. The ice in the pond was not yet dissolved, though there were some open spaces, and it was all dark-colored and saturated with water. There were some slight flurries of snow during the days that I worked there, but for the most part when I came out on to the railroad on my way home, its yellow sand heap stretched away gleaming in the hazy atmosphere, and the rails shone in the spring sun, and I heard the lark and pewee and other birds already come to commence another year with us. They were pleasant spring days, in which the winter of man's discontent was thawing as well as the earth, and the life that had lain torpid began to stretch itself. One day, when my axe had come off and I had cut a green hickory for a wedge, driving it with a stone, and had placed the hole to soak in a pond hole in order to swell the wood, I saw a striped snake run into the water, and he lay on the bottom, apparently without inconvenience, as long as I stayed there, or more than a quarter of an hour, perhaps because he had not yet fairly come out of the torpid state. It appeared to me that for a likely reason men remain in their present low and primitive condition. But if they should feel the influence of the spring of springs arousing them, they would of necessity rise to a higher and more ethereal life. I had previously seen the snakes in frosty mornings in my path, with portions of their bodies still numb and inflexible, waiting for the sun to thaw them.
Now, let's stop there as a stark reminder of the lower and less ethereal life still lived by what's sometimes referred to as mainstream society, commercially controlled society. Let's hear the following interview. This is from January 2013, Sasha Lilly of Against the Grain is interviewing resistance organizer Angela McQuinney about their efforts to resist the armed gangs who have been trying to take control over people's houses.
I'm Sasha Lilly. Foreclosures have fallen out of the news, with the percentage of banks seizing properties from homeowners having fallen 3% last year. But those numbers and the declaration that the foreclosure crisis is over are deceiving. Foreclosures are actually on the rise in much of the United States, but it's geographically uneven. In California, Nevada, and Oregon, states where foreclosures have ostensibly declined, a backlog of delayed foreclosures appears to be accumulating. My guest today, Angela McQuinney, has been working with a grassroots campaign of homeowners, their neighbors, labor unions, and Occupy activists in Portland to resist foreclosures that have been coming down the pike. She's a union organizer and works with We Are Oregon. I asked her to come on the program to talk about the contours of the campaign that they've been waging, in many ways successfully, at least so far, to prevent homeowners from being evicted from their houses through direct action. Angela, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So I wonder if you could start by giving us a sense of how serious the foreclosure crisis is in Portland.
I don't think that it is necessarily been as big as it has been in some cities. I mean, you hear about Chicago and Detroit, where whole neighborhoods have been essentially left abandoned by foreclosure and eviction. But the reality is that in a large sections of the city, it's hard to go a block without an empty house. The two-thirds of folks are still underwater, meaning they owe more on a house than it's worth. What we're seeing is that even though there was some kind of toothless foreclosure legislation last year, banks have been completely unwilling to work with families to stay in their homes. And so Portland is not a huge city, and so it's having a devastating impact to neighborhoods, particularly neighborhoods that are traditionally African-American neighborhoods in the city. The loss of those connections and neighbors is having a deep impact.
So then the question is, what is a union doing, initiating a grassroots campaign to stop evictions? I mean, usually unions are traditionally involved in organizing in the workplace, and this obviously is not the workplace, and in fact may not even involve members of the union.
Yeah, no, it involves both members and folks who are not members of the union. In fact, but it didn't really start by us saying, you know, what we want to do is resist eviction. It started very similar to how we think about organizing campaigns and work sites, in that we actually canvassed the entire city of Portland in working class neighborhoods. So we knocked on about 30,000 doors and said, the economy is awful. How is it affecting you? What do you care most about? And what would you take action to do about what's happening to you and the economic conditions you're under? And what we found was, out of that, people overwhelmingly said a few things. One was jobs. And so we started working on things like wage theft and working with low-wage workers. Another was overwhelmingly fighting foreclosure and stopping evictions. And so we started first with information sessions, just trying to understand for ourselves and help other folks understand what's actually happening. And from that, a committee of homeowners and neighbors, concerned community folks came together and has been meeting for about the last 18 months, working together through all different methods of using direct action, from delegations to banks, to pickets at banks, to pickets at the city and the county, and rallies, delegations there, to organizing to directly resist evictions and directly move people back into their homes who've either left because they were scared by bank threats or left because the sheriff forced them out.
So this is, in effect, a very extended process. I mean, rather than just an action at the house of someone who's being evicted, it sounds like this campaign has been initiated quite a while ago and is sort of accumulating over time. Is that right? I mean, is that how this was sort of conceived of, that rather than just sort of parachuting in, you all would take as much time to try and build effective support?
Yeah, I mean, when we first started with folks, to be honest, most people came and said, what we want is lawyers. And we said, okay, well, we'll see, but we aren't lawyers, so that's not what we're going to do. Let's talk about what direct action does. And we started really simply, like, could we make direct demands of banks with delegations? And in some cases, that actually worked. We actually got people terms that they could work with. They changed their mortgages, but not in enough. It wasn't enough to solve it for enough people. And so as we've worked with folks over the course of the last 18 months, those relationships have deepened, but also people have become closer and closer to the brink of eviction. And with that, we've had to think about how do we continue to build and grow support and build a movement that's strong enough to take on the idea that, you know, the only way to really stop this is to stop letting people be evicted, to like make it so that they can't take the houses back. And short of that, it doesn't appear that there's a way to get the banks to negotiate. There's not legal recourse. Lots of folks tried going after the banks for fraud, a lot of and process things that weren't done correctly in their foreclosure. The courts were completely unsympathetic and mostly tossed things out. And so far, the county has said, oh, it's awful that people are being evicted, but refused to stop evicting them. So the only thing that we've seen as a community is, you know, we have to fight on all of those fronts, and we have to be really smart about it and figure out where are our strengths and how do we play to the fact that we are in these neighborhoods and we're united in standing together with neighbors and as a community, and how can we, with that strength, actually hold these houses and keep people in their homes and stop having empty homes pop onto our streets.
So who are actually involved in this effort? Who have you brought together in it?
It's an interesting mix of folks. There are, as I said, folks who are themselves going through foreclosure, and they range, there's a mix of race and people's class backgrounds and the neighborhoods that they live in, though most, I would say, would tend towards lower middle class and working class families. There's a real mix of people who have come out in support, from longtime activists to people who just really got inspired as part of Occupy and who have come out of Occupy and really put lots of energy and effort into building things like our rapid response network and our ability to be effective in moving folks back into their homes with mass support. So it's been a big spectrum. And then I'd say the other base of support that we've really built is in every neighborhood where we have a disputed house, we do a lot of work in going out and talking with neighbors who make up a whole lot of different backgrounds and who in many cases say, you know, I am not politically a left-leaning person. Some people are extremely right-leaning, but who on the issue, on the idea of foreclosure and on the idea of a right to have a safe place to live, actually time and again have sided with their neighbors rather than with banks.
Well, I wonder if you could give us a few examples of the sort of efforts that you all have been involved in and around specific cases and how those have played out for you all.
One of the big ones that we went public in May. On May 1st, we moved Alicia Jackson back into her house. She had actually left not because she was evicted, but because the bank had threatened her. And so she self-evicted, not realizing that there would be support to stay. And so 500 folks from her neighbors and community across the city moved her back into her house and have been doing shifts to stay with her and make sure that she is safe in her house since May Day of last year. And she remains there now, although we are in a fight. The city has turned off her water and taken her water meter away, so she can't even turn it back on. and is trying to say that they should evict her because she hasn't turned her water on, while they've refused to give her the implement that would turn it on. But she's there, and she is, at this moment, supported with folks in her house. Last year, in December, one of our families that was actually the first in the state of Oregon to go public, saying that they would refuse to leave if the sheriff were to come to their house, and that they were going to refuse to leave if the bank told them to. They have been fighting for the last year. Actually, last week, the sheriff finally did come to their house and evicted them at 5:30 in the morning, in the dark, with armed police officers to kick Debbie and her kids out in their pajamas. And they have been actually taken in by a neighbor who is allowing them to stay there, and their whole neighborhood has been organizing in response, as a network of folks nationally to make a demand. Their house is owned by Fannie Mae, and they are demanding that Fannie Mae give their house back because they had actually never fully missed a payment. They were late on a payment and were put into foreclosure. They even went and tried to make up that payment with late fees and were still tracked into foreclosure. We are working with a woman named Annette Steele, who's a 79-year-old grandmother, great-great-grandmother, actually, and has an amazing support in her neighborhood. When rapid response alerts go out, and even though it's not her house that we're asking people to respond to, her neighbors run outside and make sure that no one's trying to evict Annette and have gone to her over and over and said, we will make sure that you get to stay in your home. She is one of the last African-American families on her block in what used to be a traditionally African-American neighborhood, and has spent 30 years contributing to the community, helping the school, taking care of people's children for free, and was sold a predatory loan when she went to fix her roof. That was so bad, in fact, that after paying on her loan for a couple of years, she owed more than what she had originally borrowed. And the bank has refused repeatedly to work with her about that. The original lender, of course, for most of these predatory loans folded, but then got bought out by one of the major banks. And so she is continuing to fight. The sheriff actually gave her an eviction order in July, and people came out in great numbers to support her. And we haven't heard from them since on that one. So she has been there and is there with community support. And they're typical. We actually are working with a dozen families that are kind of right there in that place of eviction or close to eviction, and then a number of families who are not quite at that point in the process but have been fighting along the way. So that's some examples, I guess.
Well, what they all seem to indicate is the kind of scale of support that one needs to even have a chance of being successful at resisting a foreclosure. I mean, you were saying that in one of these cases, there have been people taking shifts since May. So how many people does that actually involve? That seems like it would take, you know, one could imagine that people might do something like that over the course of a couple weeks, but to do it over many, many months is a whole different level of coordination and commitment.
There are a lot of really dedicated folks. I think it's true of a lot of movements, right? There are some folks who are just doing a tremendous amount. And then lots of folks who are contributing whatever time and resource they can, however big or small. And so that has been, you know, small as in, just whole neighborhoods putting out signs that we support our neighbors on their lawns and getting, you know, whole blocks to do it at once in support as just a visible show to we have hundreds of people that are part of our rapid response network and receive text messages when there's a need for supporting a home, either to move them back in or to support responding to an eviction. Those hundreds of folks are some of whom have been the core of doing sitting shifts. Other homeowners are part of that. And we have hundreds of folks who have signed up over the last year to do house sitting shifts, not just at Alicia's, but when other houses have been close to eviction, we sign up folks for shifts at those houses too. So it really has been hundreds of folks who've taken a lot of work on, and thousands of folks who've been willing to show support and show that they stand with people. And both of those things have been really important in order to create the kind of pressure that we needed to actually back off some of the more violent tactics that the police and sheriff were using in evictions, and to actually start to put real pressure back onto some of the companies that are trying to take these houses away.
Angela, you mentioned that in one of the cases you were giving of people who you all are supporting, of someone self-evicting themselves. And I wonder if you could talk more about that, because although a lot of us are aware of the scale of foreclosures, we may not realize that a lot of times people actually leave houses essentially preemptively, that the capacity of the sheriffs to turf people out may be a bit more restricted than we realize.
Yeah, actually, when we first started doing the foreclosure work, we were like, okay, let's think about down the road. We're going to need to figure out how to resist evictions. And we went and figured out the statistics of, in Portland, how many people were evicted each month due to foreclosure-induced evictions. And it was at most two. And at this time, this is the same time we were seeing, 1,500 foreclosures listed on the Portland foreclosure list. So it was impossible that only that the banks all just started those and didn't want people out of their house, and homes were going empty. And so we started to say, what is happening here? And what we realized is we actually went out and we did mailings to everybody that was in foreclosure, and then started knocking on all their doors and asking them about what was happening with them and would they be interested in standing with others to fight this. And what was happening for most folks was they felt alone, isolated, ashamed, and like they had no other recourse but to do what the bank wanted. But also the bank letters were intensely scary. They gave all kinds of dates that were made-up dates. They weren't eviction dates. They weren't enforceable by the sheriff. But people read them, and when it said, you must be out by X, Y, or Z, people thought, that's the date the sheriff comes. Not realizing that it was on bank letterhead and they had absolutely no authority to do that eviction without having gone through a court process. But what banks were trying to exploit was people's fear and have them leave so that they wouldn't have to put in the money to actually go through a court process of eviction. And what we were seeing was that most people were self-evicting, were just getting those scary letters. They were sometimes months, arguably in some cases years, from an actual eviction being able to be dealt by the sheriff. And but people were leaving because of the threatening letters to the banks. And so we spent a good 8 or 9 months mostly just trying to get out the message of don't move out. And we had lots of homeowners we were working with do a mailer where they each told their story about the phase of foreclosure that they were in and why they were choosing to resist, choosing not to move out of their home and not to give up while they were in that stage. And we would get phone calls from lots of folks as a result of those letters, trying to get the word out, doing media stuff on the radio, like, just don't move out of your house. You don't have to give up this quickly. Because it really just profits the banks when you move out preemptively. It just gives them your house and makes it easy on them while they are making it incredibly hard on the families that are involved.
So then it raises the question, since obviously when a foreclosure happens, there are various levels of involvement by different entities, the banks, the police, who may enforce them or may not get around to doing it, but when they do get involved, it can often be very violent. There's local government, the state. How did you all choose your target, which obviously one needs to in any campaign to think strategically about where you can have the most impact?
We were quite small when we started, so we didn't actually think that we could, in fact, take on all the big banks and the state and the police all at once. And so we started to look at where are there points at which direct action and intervening would actually change the dynamics enough to potentially give people more time in their house or give them an opportunity to make more demands. And that started, I mean, really very simply by trying to go after banks who were foreclosing and started to develop over time as we like worked with people in different parts of the process and they came up against different pieces of that system. You know, the bank handles just about everything with very little or no government interaction or oversight up until the house is auctioned. And even after the auction, it's really the eviction process itself that the government gets involved in, or if people proactively decide to try to sue the bank, then the courts get involved. But for the most part, the banks really control the process and all the rules, or lack thereof, around what happens in foreclosures. So we started by going after them first, but realized that that we weren't very strong when it came to attempting to change, say, the behavior of Wells Fargo by taking action just here in Portland. but that what the banks wanted, what was of value, was the house. And where we were strong was that the house is in Portland. The family is important. Portland, the community around that house doesn't want it to happen, and that is our base. That's where our strength is to not give up the house. Once the houses were given up, once people moved out, we saw that it was almost futile to continue to fight for a house because the real thing, the thing that the bank wanted, the asset, was theirs. And so even when people had moved out, we started working with them to move back into their house and say, we're not giving up our house. It's ours. It's ours. And that's been our most effective strategy, has been saying, how do we build a strong amount of community support around each house and have a committed family or individual that is asserting, this is my house and I'm going to stay here and you can't take it from me, who's willing to tell their story, work with other families in solidarity and build a movement around that and saying the house is in our neighborhoods. So we're defending our homes and our neighborhoods because we aren't close to Wall Street and we can't use the numbers we have here necessarily as effectively if what we try to do is just protest at banks.
Well, and it raises an interesting point, which is that the key tactic that you all have been using has been direct action, which some people who are, you know, involved in radical politics, actually like yourself, are used to. And then there are others who find it quite unusual. And one, I mean, these are stereotypes, of course, but one thinks of homeowners as being not necessarily the most radical bunch of people, or at least a lot of them wouldn't be. They might be more hesitant about confrontational tactics. So how did you get people to agree to these kind of tactics, which are, and in fact, can become quite confrontational?
I think, one, we started with what's the most direct way that we can influence things. And, you know, lots of folks wanted to try out the courts and actually, through real experience, saw that they didn't work, that there was no justice to be had by trying to fight the banks in the courts. Folks tried calling the banks and getting them to sit down and negotiate. They tried all the other ways. in some cases, you know, when we met folks, they had been trying all the other ways. They'd even tried mediation and all the tools that supposedly are there to help, which frankly are very few. And so through their real experience of the system having no other mechanism for them to really hold on to their house, and for many people knowing that it wasn't just a luxury to have a house, right? There wasn't a place to go if they lose their house. For many of the families we're working with, it is a very real thing that they are going to be houseless, and that community of houseless folks is growing a lot to do with families in foreclosure being kicked out of their homes. So folks really felt like, one, there's an urgency and a need, and that all the traditional ways you're offered to take action that are sort of work with the system, try to get legislation passed, tried that, didn't work, it was toothless, tried the courts, didn't work. They were disrespectful and wouldn't listen. And, you know, found out that what was really successful and what kept working was when people got together and took action very directly to get what they wanted. And also, I think the other factor is how we work with the families has been to really engage them in every single step of the way, to really engage with our whole committee around how is this action going to look? What does direct action feel like around your house? And they are very actively participating and thinking about the tone and the message and the way that those direct actions are held. And likewise, thinking really about how do we take action in a neighborhood where the place that we're taking action is actually filled with homes of other allies versus, you know, when you do a direct action downtown and really everything you're surrounded with is wealth. And so you're surrounded by towers of powerful enemies, and you might have a different posture, a different way of confronting that atmosphere versus what does it mean to take action in a neighborhood where most of the people around you want to support you. So a lot of the direct actions we did were, yeah, we moved someone back into their house, which could seem like a very confrontational action. We're reclaiming space. But we also, at the same time, held a block party. And we had kids' events and face painting and balloons. And it was a community celebration of what was possible when we got together that we invited everyone to. And it had a feeling not of just we're going to confront the system, but actually we're going to be joyful in it. We're going to be, this is a powerful moment for us as a community to come together and to frame what we want a neighborhood to be like. And sort of approaching some of our actions like that. Not to say that the police coming out and getting confrontational doesn't change the tenor of it, but certainly how families have conducted themselves and how we have has been to not try to just have violent escalation, but actually to say, no, what we want is to keep people in their homes and to keep people in the neighborhoods united, connected, and fighting together. And to do that, we build community. To do that, our actions have to be powerful and inspiring and fun.
Sure. And yet, nevertheless, there might be some neighbors who would think, well, even if this does seem powerful and joyful, I don't really want some action that brings more cops to my neighborhood. Because as you say, these foreclosures are happening disproportionately in African-American neighborhoods.
Oh, definitely. Though I have to say, overwhelmingly, neighbors have been supportive even when things have gotten challenging in their neighborhood. And, you know, every now and then, there's been a couple of times when things have been really hard. Police have come in very hard into a neighborhood, or it's gotten confrontational. And we've actually gone back out and talked to neighbors and helped them have an outlet for talking about what is the impact of this. But what's interesting and what we've seen, I don't think I mentioned this family before, but Patricia and Darren, they've been evicted twice, and we've moved them back in twice. One of their evictions actually brought out 60 sheriff and Portland police officers, including people with guns and pellet guns and pepper spray, riot gear, to move a family out of their house. And we actually thought that the neighborhood would be really, really angry, right? It was horrendous amount of confrontation. The police escalated in a really inappropriate way. What we actually saw was that about 10 days later, we successfully moved Patricia and Darren back into their house and held off them being evicted again. And what had happened actually was that the neighborhood was waiting with bated breath to see if we would come back and succeed or if those 60 police would have the final word. And when Darren and Patricia moved back in again right before Thanksgiving, the neighborhood organized in a more organic way than we had ever worked with them before, and that they started to keep an eye out for them and be on alert and to bring food over and to check on them every other day. Neighbors that bordered them in their property on each side started talking to each other about making sure that the police couldn't access Darren and Patricia. And so in an interesting way, well, I'm sure there's probably a neighbor or two who is like, I hope this never happens again. It also galvanized folks. People didn't like seeing the police in their neighborhood, but even more didn't like seeing that sort of abuse used for such a horrible purpose, for just kicking a family, one of whom, I might add, Patricia, is on oxygen. And for a while, they actually refused to give her her oxygen machine, which was still in the house after they had kicked her out. So that's the other impact, actually, is that we've seen the community actually react really negatively to the police and see how the police have escalated and the amount of public money being spent as really disgusting.
To what degree do you feel like this campaign has evolved its tactics from observing how the police react to you, and to what degree are the police studying you in turn?
I think both are happening a lot. And I should say that, you know, one of the things that we learned, especially after Darren and Patricia's eviction, where they sent the 60 police and sheriff deputies to their house, shortly after that eviction was an incredibly violent eviction of Will and Heather, where they actually burst in several doors of the house at the same time with weapons pointing at the family early in the morning, and cordoned off four blocks around their house to basically raid the house when they knew that the mother, Heather, was home by herself, and then stopped Will after he had just dropped off their 10-year-old at school and held him by the side of the road. After those two big events, we thought a lot about how do we, you know, they got faster, for one. That Will and Heather was a sort of very classic kind of raid, right? They really had thought about time of day and how difficult it would be to get to their house and how quickly they would move and all of the sorts of things that, you know, gaining a lot of community support quickly is hard to do when they're ahead of you and they have cars that can, you know, turn on their lights and go through traffic at any speed they want. And so we started to think and reassess. And I think we have done that throughout the campaign in other instances. I think this is just one of the most dramatic about what does it mean for families to think about having a safe exit when they're evicted and making it difficult, like they're not going to just leave, but that they do leave, don't get arrested, and that each time we simply move people back in and we reset the clock. We say, okay, you evict someone, we move them back in. Your eviction timeline is your own. We can't control it. But the timeline we do control is how we mobilize the community and when we mobilize them. And so one of the things we did in response to Patricia and Darren's really extreme eviction was say, okay, well, let's talk about what it means for the decision makers who don't come out to someone's lawn to actually feel what it's like to be confronted.
Although the labor movement actually has a long history, if you go back quite a ways, of direct action. In recent decades, it's something that has become much more foreign to trade unions and something that a lot of people would actually be uncomfortable with. The kinds of clashes or confrontations that you've described seem extremely charged. I mean, these confrontations with the police and people being willing to sort of put their bodies on the line. And I wonder how